The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Fundamental changes to how we live and work are on the way as Ireland is set to introduce its first ever carbon budget. Efforts to halve the country's greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 will see cuts of 4.8% in each of the next 5 years. Now, that includes 2021, so there's not much of that left. And then a cut of 8.3% from 2026 onwards. It's worth bearing in mind that emissions fell by just 3% in 2020 when the country went into lockdown during the pandemic. For more on the new carbon budget, I'm joined by Professor Peter Thorne, who's a member of the government's Climate Change Advisory Council and director of the Icarus Climate Research Centre at Maynooth University. Peter, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Now, everybody has got to play their part, each sector. So can you tell us what is expected from each sector? We're talking about, where we live, in other words, reducing the consumption of energy in the private home or in business, how we get there, which is transport, and what we eat, which is farming.
Yes, we're talking about transformational change. We're talking not necessarily about reducing energy usage, although that is clearly the optimal way to move forwards. But we're also talking about increasing the mix of renewable energy in the system. So more offshore wind in particular, but more of other renewables. We are indeed talking about the way we transport, the way we heat our homes, and the things we produce and consume, not just food. But it is all sectors of society that will be required to undertake change. Many of those changes, of course, have massive co-benefits. Who doesn't want to live in a warm, dry house? Who doesn't want a nice electric car that is cheaper to run? So many of these things are substantive benefits to society.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the energy saving benefits, say, of retrofitting a typical house, and there are one-off houses, there are big houses, there are small houses, there are very, very old houses, very inefficient houses. But if we could take the generality of things, we're talking about the two-bed semi, which populates the country. What would it cost to retrofit that to a B standard, a good B standard, and how much money and therefore, through energy would we save?
So it is inherently dependent upon the building. There are more qualified individuals than myself to give a real answer.
I'm just wondering, the recommendations have come from the council, so you must have done the sums in some way.
Yes, we have done the sums indeed, and if in the report we provide guidance on this, and it's clear that the government will need to step in a substantial way to intervene to help undertake the transition of retrofitting homes. So retrofitting a home is probably thousands to tens of thousands of euros. We need to find ways to enable citizens to do that. We need to intervene for citizens who can't. The savings at the other end are substantial, but not substantial enough to make it a no-brainer decision on most people's parts. So the government will need to intervene.
So the idea, you often hear ads on the radio here about changing your lighting to energy-saving lighting, the LED lighting, and the companies say, you'll pay for it very quickly through the energy you save. But in terms of heating and retrofitting an old inefficient house, it could be decades before you'd have a proper payback.
Yes, potentially, and that's where we really need to think about how we offer financial support and incentives. Of course, performing a retrofit probably increases substantially the value of the property where you're a private owner. There is a major challenge for the rental market component. What is in it for landlords? So there are undoubtedly challenges. I'm not going to sugarcoat this and say this can be done easily, but these are all surmountable.
Now, if we did manage to retrofit the bulk of our housing stock by 2030, What impact would that have in percentage terms of the reduction that we require, 50%?
So it wouldn't get us to the 50%, but it would be a very substantial contribution. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but from memory, it's about 15%, 20% of emissions are due to the due to the residential sector. If we can get that right down towards no emissions, which we will need to do by 2050, then we would make a substantive contribution, but it alone won't get us to 51%.
Okay. So let's take that private house. I'm concentrating on the private dwelling, first of all, and indeed office buildings and school buildings and so on. So we put PV, which is very cheap, on the roof of every available building. How much of a reduction would that give us?
Well, it would give us additional electricity from a fundamentally clean source. There's obviously a carbon price in terms of the manufacture of the PV. And it would also provide to those individuals who produce more energy than they consume the opportunity to feed it back into the grid and gain a feed-in tariff, assuming that the government provides such a mechanism.
Okay, so on the one hand, you, with a little bit of battery storage in your house and you're collecting PV all day until dusk, you may be selling during the day and buying from the grid during the night. But there are two elements of saving here. You're supplying the grid and you're reducing your own consumption of grid electricity. So if we any estimate, if we did that comprehensively, how far that would get us in reducing our targets?
So it would reduce, the main thing it would do would be it would fundamentally reduce our dependency upon fossil fuel generation on the national grid, and therefore it would reduce the energy emissions.
So but do we have any idea of, you know, if we did 50% of our housing stock could install PV, which again would be at a cost,
yes.
How much of a contribution towards our targets would that be?
It would be a matter of percentages. So it would be percentage points. So it would be substantial. But again, it would not get us to 51%. I mean, the fundamental thing is there is no single silver bullet here. It is necessary for an all of government, all sectors and all elements of society approach to reach this 51%
now,
target.
You talk about us becoming a net exporter of green energy, which with the wind resource we have would be absolutely fabulous. We presumably get credits then for our excess of green energy that can offset some of the carbon that we use.
We can indeed potentially get that. I mean, it will depend upon how the carbon accounting at the EU and international levels evolves over the coming years. But irrespective of whether we can gain carbon credits from it, we can gain financial benefit from it. If we are producing more energy than we need and we are exporting it to the continent, that is an income stream for us. And presently we spend millions per week importing fossil fuels from countries of, in many cases, dubious human rights and other aspects. We could be producing all the energy we need and exporting it and gaining an income.
Yeah, it would seem unfair that we were supplying, say, green energy to Britain and not getting a credit for it, helping them hit their targets. That would seem anomalous that we didn't get credit for that.
Yeah, well, and I believe at the present time in the international accounting system, we would. I just cannot guarantee that that would be the case in the future. But we would anyway be gaining financially if we produce more energy than we need and we export it.
Now, the next area is transport and the electrification of the motor fleet. At the moment, there are some incentives for buying electric cars up to a certain price, and the price of these cars is coming down. But such is the reliability of the existing petrol and diesel fleet that it's quite commonplace to see 10, 15-year-old cars looking spick and span on our roads. They've got to be replaced.
They will have to be replaced. And if transport has to take up proportionately more of the lifting, to meet the target, then there will be increasing amount of need to retire prematurely internal combustion engine cars, and replace them with electric cars, and that ultimately will come with a cost. So one thing to be very clear to your listeners is that to reach the 51% target does require substantial effort from all sectors. And if we give any sector, for any reason, an easy time of it, other sectors have to do more and more lifting, and that lifting by other sectors has more and more price. So it really is a relatively narrow path, with all sectors showing great ambition, that leads us to 51%.
Now, the most controversial sector, I suppose, is agriculture, because we are a huge net exporter of food, even though we do import maybe more than we should. We produce in particular ways lots of beef, lots of dairy, selling milk powder to the world and so on and so forth. Reducing the national herd will create some significant hardship for that sector.
If that is the way that the government decides to go, then without, absent of supports, absent of developing new and novel high-value markets for new and distinct products, and absent of policy interventions, absolutely, and the council report makes absolutely and abundantly clear that significant effort will be required from government to develop those new niche markets, to encourage diversification of the agricultural sector, and to support the farmers through the transition.
Yeah. Now, we come to some of the global issues when we think about agriculture, because we know that Bolsonaro and his pals in the Amazon basin are encouraging the destruction of rainforest, which is so vital as a carbon sink for the world and also as a source perhaps of new drugs and all the rest of it, in order to graze cattle or grow crops that are not particularly sustainable. I mean, what sense does it make to stop the production of beef and dairy from lush green pastures which have been deforested for hundreds of years? So we stop doing that, and down in the Amazon basin, they continue. Show me the logic.
So we need, this is the classic tragedy of the commons that, if you like, that we have, someone put their goat on the village green and other people have put their goats on the village green, and now the village green is being denuded and nobody wants to remove their goat from the village green. We have agency over what we do as a country. We also have the ability to influence other countries. If you look at the number of pledges that are coming into COP, most countries are coming in with net zero ambitions to 2050. If countries are serious about that, and I believe they are, then every country will be grappling with exactly the challenges that we are grappling with. I wish I lived in a world where the Amazon was not being destroyed. But our not taking action is not going to help us to make the moral argument with the Brazilian government.
Okay, so it's about being seen to be the best boy in class, even though we make precious little difference to what's happening. It is that we all do our bit globally. Each citizen does his or her bit, and therefore, if everyone did their bit, we'd have a solution. That's the logic.
Yes, and I mean, one thing to make abundantly clear is that if every person in the world had the greenhouse gas emissions profile of Ireland, we would be sitting at 3 degrees centigrade warming. So we emit more per person than the global average. We're currently at 1 degree, 1 and a bit degrees warming. So there are definitely arguments to be had. But the fundamental truth of the matter is that we are emitting, per capita in Ireland, we are emitting enough to have warmed the world 3 degrees, which means there must be a huge number of people elsewhere in the world who are emitting far less than we are.
Who are the other big offenders if we're bad?
There are far bigger offenders. Canada, Saudi Arabia, USA clearly is a very big on a per capita basis. There are numerous resources where your listeners can go and find per capita basis greenhouse gas emission data. We're by no means the worst, but we're clearly not best in class.
Now, the Chinese have agreed to stop building new coal-fired stations maybe by the end of the decade, but for the moment they're still building them and opening them. What sense does it make to tell someone in rural Ireland they can't burn turf while the Chinese are still doing that?
So the Chinese are indeed building new coal-powered plants, but the Chinese have also installed more renewable, more solar and wind than the rest of the world combined in recent years.
Well, they have more people.
They've got more people, and they're growing economically, and they're less developed than we are. So you get into this whole set of arguments about equity and inequality and what's right and just nationally and internationally. Climate justice has a national dimension, which the council have spoken about at length, the need for a just transition, the need for us to support those citizens who are disadvantaged by the transition, to help them, to retrain them, to ensure they have good jobs, they have good quality homes. We need to do climate justice internally, but also climate justice has international dimensions. Yeah. Is it fair for us to say you cannot develop because you are just starting to develop now, whereas we're sitting here pretty as a developed nation? There are real questions.
Yeah, indeed there are. But I mean, the Chinese have a space station up there. They're talking about landing people on the moon and using the moon as a headquarters to head to Mars. I wouldn't like to say China is undeveloped as a nation. How they choose to spend their resources might be another question that could be asked about China. What about wildfires? I mean, I'm just thinking back to the wildfires of California and how much CO2 and other pollutants went into the atmosphere. And how does that compare to Ireland's annual output?
So the emissions from the large wildfires we saw this year were very large, but they're they're exacerbated by climate change. There is no doubt about that. They are, though, part of the natural carbon cycle. They are recycling the carbon that is in the surface component of the carbon cycle, whereas the carbon emissions that we are undertaking are fossil carbon. They are carbon that was laid down in the time of the dinosaurs and has been
No, not
away.
In terms of, CH4, which is methane. That carbon is only in the grass.
The methane is both from, again, methane is both from fossil and from modern carbon cycle components.
But the belching cattle, yeah. They get their methane from eating grass, which is not historic. It's contemporary.
No. Yes, but there is also fossil methane from fossil fuels, I guess. Yeah.
Sure, and hopefully we can get rid of some of those. All right, so basically we have to tighten our belts in agriculture, in transport, and in the way we heat our homes and offices and so on. One of the listeners says, as regards global warming, your expert said there's no silver bullet. There is. It's nuclear power, says Bill. Did the Climate Council look at nuclear power at all? It's old technology, but it's been abandoned, but very effective molten salt technology, and also compact nuclear reactors that could be built and delivered pretty quickly.
So that was not within the terms of reference of the carbon budget process. We, of course, de facto use quite a lot of nuclear power through the interconnectors to the UK and onto the continent. So we're already using nuclear power, even if we're not producing it indigenously. That is a question that would be, if the government asked the council to look at it, they would. But right now, legally, via the constitution, there is no ability to consider nuclear power. So that would need to be resolved first.
The constitution. Is nuclear power mentioned in the constitution?
From my memory, from helping with the Citizens Assembly and Chief Justice Lafoy, she said that nuclear was not possible constitutionally.
We'll have to check that one out.
I would have to check that.
Okay. I don't expect you to be an expert on the Constitution as well as climate. Peter, thank you very much for joining us. Professor Peter Thorne, member of the Climate Change Advisory Council. Now, Jim Mulhall, chairman of the Kilkenny branch of the Irish Farmers Association, has been listening to all of that. Jim, what do you make of what's ahead? It looks pretty bleak for farming.
Good morning, Pat, and thanks for having me on. I think the word I would use, well, I mean, let's be clear in the sense that the targets haven't been set yet. I mean, I've read the report and or some of the report, and I've seen the ambition of 4.8% in the next few years, in the next between now and 2025. But I suppose our past, there has been talks of 21 to 30%, and I think it's very clear here. I mean, this is going to have a seismic effect. And I don't use the word seismic easily, but it is going to have a seismic effect, not just on farming and agriculture, but on rural Ireland. You know, I mean, if the changes that are being proposed, and you mentioned the national herd, but if the changes that are proposed have the effect that we have to decarbonize, which we're not afraid in terms of the challenges ahead, but if the changes that are proposed have an impact on our ability to operate properly as farmers, Pat, it'll have a seismic effect on the rural economy.
You know, I did mention to Peter the whole question of beef being produced elsewhere in the world or dairy being produced elsewhere in the world where cattle are in sheds and eating pellets, which are manufactured and therefore have an energy input into them, that there doesn't seem to be an appreciation internationally of grassland as a responsible way of producing beef. But I know there are experiments. Trinity College did an experiment about seaweed to stop the CO2, the CH4 belching and so on and so forth. But how expensive that would be, I don't know. Can farmers do anything else?
Of course they can, Pat. I mean, look at it, and this boils down to, in the previous government, there was a proposal that we would reduce our emissions by up to 15%. And Chagos undertook what was called at the time a marginal abatement cost curve, where they would actually find ways within agriculture that we could reduce our carbon emissions. And they met that target. And I suppose now, Pat, the important thing is that the Chagos and the Trinities and the researchers of this world would find a way or a pathway for us to reach this this requirement, to reach our 21%. Hopefully that's where it'll finish up. But I think, I mean, you used the word yourself, silver bullet, and I've heard the mention of the national herd and that being mentioned in various different media in the past few days. I mean, it's simplistic in the extreme to suggest by just destocking that we can meet that. I have financial commitments, and every other farmer in the country has financial commitments to meet based on the size of my own herd. And to in some way suggest that just by taking a simplistic approach and reducing the size or the population of the herd, that this will potentially solve the problem. I just think it's the silver bullet, Pat, and I don't think it's going to work.
All right. Well, look, I suspect there may be trouble ahead in terms of these measures, but Jim Mulhall, dairy farmer, chairman of the Kilkenny branch of the Irish Farmers Association. Jim, thank you very much for joining us.